Please be seated. We're in your hands, Mr.
Yes,
Walsh.
Thank you, Mum. Mum, you should have very shortly three documents. The first one is self-evident. That's the closing submissions. Yep. It basically is a function of being remote and needing to print these submissions yesterday lunchtime.
Yes.
Which predates the discussion with Mr. De Pelsmaker. I did some homework overnight, but I couldn't incorporate them into the submissions proper.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to talk you through that when I get to the relevant part. And the main change from the written submissions is contained within the loose one-pager,
right,
which is the a proposed restricted discretionary rule, picking up on comments from the court, in particular Commissioner Edmonds, to Mr. De Pelsmaker. And I should just note that Ms. Stiles and I have worked this up, so it's had input from Ms. Stiles. And the approach we took was to include the controlled activity, matters of control, and move them across as matters of discretion. And then in F, that probably was the challenging matter. And Mum, I say it's challenging because there's the two different constraints. On one hand, Your Honour has noted in her view that duration is not always neutral.
No.
It can be, but it might not always be. And on this, and against that is Your Honour's comments also that the architecture of Plan Change 7 doesn't provide for the merit-based assessments.
Mm-hmm.
So those two countervailing considerations. Mm-hmm. And as a way of addressing those, Mum, Ms. Stiles and I have come up with a matter of discretion F, which in my submission appropriately tries to respond to those two competing considerations.
Mm.
The third matter, or the third document you have, I've referred to two cases in my closing submissions that I didn't refer to in my opening, and so I've just provided copies of those two decisions, Mum.
Good. Okay.
All right. Now, I should also just start by saying the submissions are longer than I would have preferred for a closing, and the reason for that is essentially because, unlike the parties you've already heard from this morning, Mr. De Pelsmaker hasn't, in terms of his primary recommendation to you, hasn't accepted the relief that Trustpower is seeking. So I have to address that in writing, but I may not have to address that orally with the court, and we might take that as read with your leave at some point.
Do bear in mind the what I said to, who was it, Mr. Anderson, does the court need to make a decision? You know, one of the your points in your opening submission was that renewables could be seen as being both tier two, tier three. If we don't need to decide that, then we won't, because it's a fairly significant issue.
Well,
that'll be a coup.
Which is why Mr. Anderson suggested not deciding
yes,
that.
Yes, that's right.
And Mum and I thought that would be a good byproduct of this decision if you found in favour of my submissions. But I do take your point, but I might just comment on Mr. Anderson's submissions in respect of the Tier 2 matter.
Oh, you certainly can respond to those,
yes, and probably just before we get into these. Mum, I've gone back and looked at my opening submissions.
Yeah.
I did not use climate change or the health effects associated with climate change as a basis for submitting that electricity is a Tier 2 matter.
I didn't think
matter.
You did. I didn't even go there. It was practical than that.
Yeah, it was practical. Yeah. So it wasn't so confined as climate change.
No.
At all.
Mm.
In terms of Mr. Anderson's other comments around the application of the MPS REG, I would just point out that despite Mr. Anderson's submissions, Section 67 does require you to give effect to all MPSs, and that includes that. So whilst you might not, in your decision, it's open to you not to engage on a large analysis of the REG, you still nonetheless need to give effect to it and be satisfied that you're giving effect to it because of 67. So I'm not so sure that that one can be sidestepped as neatly as Mr. Anderson suggests. But you will recall...
That's to do with the well, if the, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if the NPSF REG says this is an inallocative regime for fresh water, it might say that, but then there's the, both those NPSs, in fact, three NPSs, are in play.
Yeah.
And so to the, I guess to the extent that it is on the plan change, how do those NPSs, how are those NPSs given effect to, I think is the key question.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the other point I was going to make around the REG and Mr. Anderson inviting you to either not address or to disagree with is Honour Judge Whiting's decision in Carter Holt. I was just going to note that, to be honest, in terms of Plan Change 7, it's not a full allocation regime in the same sense that Carter Holt was dealing with. Here we've got a limited class of deemed permit holders with a rollover set of provisions, essentially, and not a, a full environmental assessment. You know, for example, other permit holders in these same rivers that the deemed permit holders could take water from aren't part of this allocation process. So really it's just the consenting regime is as far as it is. So my view that the preamble doesn't cause any problems. So but well, that's in my opening submissions. But
I think if you take, if there are carve-outs, in this case a carve-out for Trustpower or a carve-out for Earnscliff, I think, or Earnscliff, maybe, I don't know, Mr. DePaul's still thinking about that, but if there are named carve-outs as opposed to policies that seek something for hydro, then the scope is very much more limited and more focused. But there is an allocation of water under resource consent.
Is
it an allocative regime? Well, if it's just focusing on trust power, maybe not. I mean, and we'll hear... Or maybe it is. We'll hear from Mr. Moore about that.
I understand why some parties have submitted to you, ma'am, at the start of the hearing in particular, that this is a, an allocated regime, and there's an element, of, and I'm not saying there's no element of allocation because it's providing for a framework for consenting, but in my submission, it's not a full allocative planning framework with all allocations in play under this narrow plan change 7, and therefore the preamble doesn't present any issues and feel that it can. Carter Holt says it need not. And then my third backup submission was, well, even if you disagree with me on those first two points, the RPS still provides you with a way forward for providing for renewable energy. And Mr. Anderson, probably the first time we've ever agreed on anything, did agree on that. So, Mum, they were the points I just wanted to say, respond to with Mr. Anderson on that. So I come to my introduction, and in opening Trustpower's case, my overarching submission was that without amendments of the nature sought by Trustpower, PC7 is an inappropriate, albeit interim, planning framework. And I made that submission on the basis that it didn't give effect to higher order RMA planning documents. And Mr. DePalsmaker has been rather refreshingly frank at times in terms of acknowledging those matters that it doesn't give effect to those higher order documents fully. Now, while the precise relief sought by Trustpower has quite properly been refined during the hearing, my principal submission stands. How to provide for hydroelectricity generation activities within Plan Change 7 is a key issue, not the key issue, but a key issue for the court. Mum, in these closing submissions, I don't intend to retraverse material that I had in my opening. I stand by my opening submissions. I haven't seen a need to go back and abandon any of those. So I don't comment on how this relates to Trustpower. The court is well versed on that. I don't comment on the legal framework generally, and I don't provide a detailed analysis why hydro should be treated differently, or provide a detailed explanation lying behind the relief sought, but I do want to step you through the relief sought by Trustpower, which I've annexed at the back of these submissions when I get to those. And also, Mum, I don't address you in any detail on the RPS because that day is yet to come in terms of addressing the court on those provisions. I wonder, Mum, if I could, with your leave, having said that, take 2.1 and 2.3 as read. That simply is a reflection of my opening submissions around the relationship between the two MPSs.
Yeah.
But at 2.4, since my opening submissions, the High Court, Justice Palmer, has issued a decision that is consistent with the approach I submitted, should be taken in respect of the relationship between the MPS-FM and the MPS-REG in the context of Plan Change 7.
Now, happily, I have read that decision.
This is the only bit I'm quoting from that decision.
Pardon?
This is the only bit I'm quoting from that decision.
And I thought, well, golly, the exercise now before the court is to line up all three planning, you know, MPS instruments and look at the differences and nuances in their words as it works its way down. And I was really looking forward to your submission, how you do that, you think, rather than
Justice Palmer had the benefit of a recently adopted regional coastal environmental plan.
Yeah.
You don't. And the closest you have is the recently notified proposed regional regional statement. And that has a long way to travel before it's set. I think the fundamental issues guidance that Justice Palmer gave in respect of neither trumping one another and reconciling them stands, but you don't have that fallback because you have older planning documents. But having said that, the operative regional policy statement does provide you perhaps your roadmap. And that's why I spent some time in the opening submissions with addressing some of those policies.
Remind me, what does the operative, this is the operative RPS, what doesn't it do? Because I didn't think, doesn't engage the MPSUD, of course it couldn't because, you know, that's really new, doesn't engage with any version, as I understand it, of the MPS-FM. No excuses there, but that means that there's an excuse for 2021, but otherwise not. And does it engage with REG? It does to a point.
It did to a point.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying it's a perfect roadmap and it will take you down some bumpy roads and some dead ends, I think. But that is what you have, and so I think the task of the court is to sort of try to reconcile that. And then I think Davidson says, failing all that, that's what part two is still there for.
Yeah, so in lining up those three MPSs, we're going to find a lot of gaps, even for the REG, MPS-REG, which it does engage with. There are gaps.
Yes.
And then there are complete misses for those two other MPS instruments. And you're saying, so your approach is not, I think what you're saying is, Justice Palmer is saying is go back up to part two as opposed to going back up to the MPS instrument itself. So if the RPS is not dealing with the MPS-FM, you don't go to the MPS-M, you go to part two, is that what you're saying?
It's not what I'm saying.
You think that's what Justice Palmer's saying?
Yeah. I think he certainly has...
You leapfrog the MPS instrument.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at my quote.
Yeah.
He goes back to, he says, neither the MPS, NZCPS, nor the MPS-ET should necessarily be treated as trumping the other, and neither should be given priority over or give way to the other.
Yeah.
And that's quite a challenge, actually, because in some respects, the MPS-FM at times will conflict with the REG and vice versa.
Yeah.
So their terms, but he says their terms need to be carefully examined and reconciled if possible before turning to that question. So I think he does envisage some analysis within the two two or three MPSs as it is here.
Yeah.
And somehow you are required to examine and reconcile those if possible. And I think your part two is there as the backstop.
Okay, so you don't find... So looking at the actual planning instruments, then going back up to the MPSM themselves, if the planning instruments are not particularly engaging.
Yeah.
And then failing that, going up to... And if you still can't get the answer, go to part two.
Well, yeah, because... I shouldn't say yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Right.
Because the comments that I've highlighted there in terms of Justice Palmer's application of the Supreme Court decision indicates some analysis within the MPSs and reconciliation by the court.
Within the MPSs themselves, yeah. And, okay. Anyway, I thought, that's a large task.
But I was
thinking that the lawyers would do it for me.
Well, I've tried in part.
Yeah.
because I've submitted that I don't think that, in terms of the REG and the FM in my opening submissions I submitted, they weren't in conflict.
Mm.
And I did take issue with the approach of Otago Regional Council that have picked and choose which parts of the MPS FM they think that they can... bring forward into Plan Change 7 and I haven't heard a good reasoning why other aspects, other than the ones that require consultation and all those setting of values, why other aspects, for example, around Policy 4 and Policy 15 on the climate change, why those parts can't have some recognition within Plan Change 7. If you're picking some parts of the MPS FM, then you should bring in what you can as soon as reasonably practical.
Is the caveat to that, though, that is true, but to the extent that it's on the plan change, that you're actually dealing with a matter which is on the plan change?
Well, it fitted my case, ma'am, in terms of having some recognition of hydro, which I submitted is within or is on the plan change. Because as notified and still as Mr. De Pelsmaker stands by, there is no different recognition of renewable energy. So I think that the as the case has evolved, at least the thinking and the questions from the court perhaps indicate that some of these matters have been overtaken through the courts teasing out with the various witnesses as to how to provide that recognition in a carve-out or an exemptions sense. So I think that may have responded to those initial submissions in terms of how to do that rather than in a policy sense.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, that'll be fair. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Now, during the hearing, so I'm at paragraph section 3 now, so paragraph 3.1. During the hearing, certain matters have been agreed between the planners and technical witnesses, largely summarised in the joint witness statement of 21 May, which goes some way towards addressing Trustpower's concern. I should just say, Trustpower... had a lot of input around the schedule, and the schedule has been vastly improved from the notified version, which, frankly, it was unclear as to whether that schedule even was intended to apply to non-irrigation uses. So we've travelled a long way, and Mr. Mitchell is quite content with the schedule as contained in the final version, and we just need to do that final verification of that submission with the changes that Mr. De Pelsmaker is going to make in response to the Commissioner Bunting's comments. However, more fundamental concerns of Trustpower, including the provision for a framework for certain activities to access for longer-term consents in 6 years, remain outstanding, at least in terms of the provisions put forward to the court by the Council. In his statement of evidence and reply, Mr. De Pelsmaker includes a section addressing hydroelectricity generation, and he acknowledges that Plan Change 7, as notified, would have established a regional planning framework that was inconsistent with higher order planning instruments and statutes, which I understand to include the REG. Mr. De Pelsmaker then fairly summarises the key concerns raised by Trustpower and others, and I just want to commend Mr. De Pelsmaker in his reply. I thought he very fairly set out the alternative positions of all the witnesses, and it was a fair and fulsome summary of those concerns. And Mr. Pausmaker makes a new recommendation to amend, and I set that out in respect of that matter, and Trustpower agrees with that amended, that recommendation amendment, which addresses a matter that was raised in evidence. But beyond that proposed minor amendment, Mr. Spousemaker's latest recommended wording provides no additional recognition for hydroelectricity activities. And he remains, at least in writing, firm in his view, but he was a little bit more equivocal when put to the sword by Commissioner Edmonds around the activity status. And I just say that his position is despite his frank acknowledgements around the risks and costs associated with his proposed approach. And I just set that out, ma'am, in 3.5. Those risks and costs in my submission, I'm at 3.6, runs counter to the policy positions in the REG, the MPSFM, and I think that I don't want to lose sight that I'm not submitting its REG to the cost of MPSFM. The two on this point, on these points can be reconciled, and the partially operative RPS. In 3.7, I'm not sure if I need to, in 3.8, need to take you through that. That's more just providing some response and rebuttal to Mr. Housemaker's primary recommendation, and I just feel I'm in a wee bit of a parallel universe arguing two cases, ma'am.
That's all right. I just want to read that to myself, though, because otherwise I'm...
Thank you, Mark. So turning to Mr. Pausmaker's alternative option that he suggests may be open to you for a longer duration. At the end of the section of his reply addressing hydroelectricity, Mr. Pausmaker makes the following acknowledgement. For a variety of reasons, the Environment Court may be minded to adopt a different position with regard to the management of some HEG schemes. If that is the case, an alternative option would be to amend Plan Change 7 to include a new DA rule for takes and or uses of water authorised by deem permits associated with the operation of the Waipori and Deepstream HEG schemes, only for a term that, brackets, better aligns with the expiry dates of other consents authorising the operation of these schemes. Mr. DePalsmaker then provides some potential alternative wording that he considers provides a pragmatic planning response. The Trustpower disagrees with Mr. DePalsmaker's rationale for limiting the duration of replacement consents to 2035. It also disagrees with Mr. DePalsmaker's assertion that his alternative proposal is effective in terms of addressing Trustpower's concerns. It is not. Trustpower considers that Mr. DePalsmaker's alternative relief is an improvement on his primary recommended relief, but it still does not go quite far enough. And I'll take you through now the relief that Trustpower has sought. And Mum, and we've tried to respond to the concerns expressed by the court and the parties and constrained the relief that Trustpower originally sought. I will outline the evolution of the relief sought by Trustpower at this hearing and the alternative relief Trustpower is now proposing, which builds on the wording proposed by Mr. DePausmaker. The relief sought in Ms. Stiles' summary evidence I've attached. That is an extra A, just so you can follow, track that through, but I don't think I need to step you through that. As the hearing progressed, the relief sought by Trustpower has been refined, including trying to take account of matters raised by the court and other parties, as I said. The relief most recently sought by Trustpower is in the wording attached to Ms. Stiles' summary statement. The wording sought in Ms. Stiles' summary statement, along with those initials, is in A. And Trustpower would support relief of the nature contained in Annexure A, or wording to similar effect. But I want to have a better go at it than that, Mum, and so I've put forward Annexure B, which includes this one pager on the RDA, and I want to talk to that for the remainder of my submissions. So, in recent weeks, Trustpower sought to engage in discussions with Council to narrow or resolve issues between Trustpower and the Council, including in light of the Court's comments regarding hydroelectricity during the hearing and the issues raised by the parties. No substantive response has been received from Council beyond being served Mr. DePausmaker's statement of reply. Despite this, Trustpower has sought to further refine potential alternative amendments to PC7 in an effort to provide both for Trustpower's concerns and also address the issues raised by the parties in the court. That relief is now proposed to set out in Annexure B. So, Mum, I wonder if I take you to Annexure B and come back and see what I'm up to. And I'll just propose just to talk you through the couple of pages in B. So hopefully the printer has made sure that it's in colour. And the tracking in red...
We've just got black and white, but...
Sorry, I'm on... I'm still in my main submission.
Sorry, I thought you were taking us to Annexure B, which is your Annexure B plus one page.
I'll explain that one page, how that fits in.
Back in the submission.
So, Mum, I haven't gone through and reproduced another version of Plan Change 7. The changes, for example, to the schedule and the RDA rule around if you're not in compliance with the schedule. I've adopted a position, for better or for worse, that they're kind of locked in.
So the changes to the schedule?
Yep.
Okay, and what was the other thing?
The RDA rule, for the 6 years still, but you don't comply with the schedule, it gave you that alternative pathway. Because, as you may recall, Trustpower couldn't avail itself of the controlled activity, even if it was willing to take six years, because of the problems in the schedule. And then we still have some issues in the schedule around the need for a more... hate this word, but more bespoke solutions around modelling and synthetic data. So that's so that's why we still support that RDA rule. But I'll set out, but I haven't included those in this because, I sort of have treated those as locked in. Ms. Stiles, in terms of the objective, Ms. Stiles was the version A camp. I have proposed a, and this fits with our earlier relief, I have proposed changes to policy 10A22, and that's in respect of new consents, but I haven't tried to, we've retreated, in my view, considerably. We're not seeking that as to apply to all hydro. You have no evidence before you on all hydro within Otago. And I also haven't sought to have a longer-term consenting regime for all Trustpower assets. And the reason for that is that Peiro and Petiaroa has that linkages with irrigation. And so I felt that that was a fair concession to make and jettison that scheme, because that brought in difficulties we didn't need. And so I've made suggestions around a longer term consenting for just Waipori and Deepstream, which is essentially one and the same, they're functionally integrated. And then I thought, well, how do we get over this fact that the policy in the water plan, the operative water plan, when it comes to duration, isn't the be-all and end-all. It's pretty good, but it's not great. And so I've tried to bolster that in the context of Plan Change 7 for those applications by including some sort of considerations around effects associated with a duration period exceeding 6 years. And that doesn't suffer from the same difficulties of the merits base, because at least in the water plan there is that more of that machinery than Plan Change 7.
So, remind me, Policy 6419, is that the duration policy in the water plan?
Yes, ma'am.
Which is the one that inevitably leads to a 35-year consent, if you have a look at the text following it, explanation and reasons?
Which is why I've tried to bolster it in, through Plan Change 7, so I don't have any scope issues, by trying to say that in addition to those matters, you will also consider any environmental effects associated with a longer-term consent.
Well, and disregard the explanation and reasons that say, yeah, you ought to have a 35-year, which lead you to a 35-year consent?
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to write that in too, because, oh, I don't know, it's not sounding attractive at the moment.
Okay, that's disappointing. The reason why I've still hung on to the new consents is the TrustPower has two applications currently sitting in ORC.
Yeah.
And one, which gets caught by, relates to the Beaumont water race, and it gets caught, because it's a new permit, it gets caught by the six-year policy direction. That consent is to bypass and to allow the water to continue to flow down an ephemeral stream to ensure the structural integrity of the Beaumont water race. Mm. And that's absolutely essential, because a few years ago, TrustPower got prosecuted for a blowout event where sediment entered the Clutha River because the race received more water than it could handle. So it seems a perverse outcome that something that is there to protect structural integrity of infrastructure gets caught by a six-year permit.
Yeah.
And that, this was just my solution to try and provide for that.
Okay.
That's the reason why I've said that TrustPower doesn't have, I have no knowledge of any big new enhancement to the Waipori scheme other than that application that I've talked about, and the one I've also mentioned, which was the capturing of some flood flows in the deep stream. They're the two applications before ORC.
Which one has to do with Beaumont of those two, or is that a third?
So there's the Beaumont, it's called the Beaumont Bypass application, because it bypasses the water race, and the second is a deep stream enhancement, where it captures some additional flood flows from the deep stream diversion, and that's a water permit under the RMA.
So both the Beaumont Bypass and the Deep Stream Enhancement,
yes,
they are new applications,
correct,
not replacement consents.
No, not replacement consents, new applications.
New applications.
Yes.
And sorry to be so obtuse, but I simply don't know your business like you do, but are they, when you're referring to Waipori and Deep Stream, do you mean the Beaumont Bypass and Deep Stream Enhancement, or do you mean something else? You've got Waipori and Deep Stream Hydro.
As the schemes.
And so
those are two applications, the Deep Stream Enhancement and the Beaumont Bypass, are associated with the Waipori and Deep Stream schemes.
Okay.
So there was evidence on all of
this. Was there?
Yes, there was. Nicola Foran provided some evidence on it. And you recall some interchange between myself and Mr. Moore, the difficulty, because the trespass applications, I didn't want to file evidence on all the applications because we're not called in these proceedings. So I gave you some evidence, but not volumes. But there is some evidence.
So really, what you're proposing here is for those two new resource consent applications that they proceed in the ordinary way under the operative plan, but that the operative plan policy 6419 in sense is amended to introduce a consideration of its environmental effects.
For the longer duration.
For a longer duration.
Yeah.
And so then the question would be, is that on the plan change to be proposing a policy which in effect amends even for a limited circumstances of the schemes that you have noted,
yeah,
but would amend the operative plan?
Well, it wouldn't be on the plan change in terms of scope,
yeah,
if I sought to amend that policy. I can't amend policy 6419. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm. No,
but
can't.
I've tried to do it within the to achieve the same outcome,
yeah,
within the context of Plan Change 7.
Well,
which is on the plan change, because the Plan Change 7 says for new consents, you're limited to 6 years.
Was there any... So this is new, because it's text in red, and I'm assuming this is new to what Ms. Stiles' evidence.
No.
She wanted this originally. And I'm sorry.
She has...
So it's not new to Ms. Stiles' evidence.
Well, the wording is more constrained than Ms. Stiles' evidence.
Mm.
Ms. Stiles was very clear she wanted the ability for hydro, generally, to have a longer than 6 year consent.
Mm.
And I've thought, well, I'm not going to get that through. Let's constrain it to what I think we have a reasonable chance of getting through, which is to the Waipurium deep strain.
Mm.
So it's within scope of our submissions,
because
it's a very much constrained outcome from what we originally sought.
And your reference to environmental effects in this context of duration is because you accept duration is not neutral. It may, in some circumstances, be, but in this case, is not neutral.
Not as an absolute statement. I would accept that duration may not be neutral, but I don't accept that it is not neutral in all cases.
So
it can be.
And so in the case of hydro, you accept that it may not be neutral and consequently an assessment of effects on the environment pertaining to, you know, the duration.
No, Your Honour, it's more that I've been listening to your comments,
yeah,
and your view that you don't consider duration neutral.
Often it's not. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I've tried to respond to that rather than being what I think. Yes.
Okay, all right.
Not trying to be cute about it, that's...
But, you know, sometimes, though, the court actually just asks questions because it is just questions of clarification.
Yeah.
Not indicating an outcome.
No, and that's the challenge.
Sometimes,
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes we make...
Taken too literally, I think.
We're taken too literally, often, actually.
Go, oh, yeah, that's fine, then we're off on to the next thing.
No, and it's
sometimes
very,
we test thinking, just to, not because we actually thought it was a good idea, but because we wanted to see, could it be... could it be closed down? Should it be closed down? And that might have been our thinking. So we'd put it forth, had it closed down, we go, well, let's move on to the next thing.
Fully accept that. And, Your Honour, you often preface your questioning this, should the court be so minded and we're exploring. So I don't take as gospel and translate each question into the court's decision. So I fully don't do that.
No.
The issue is that, and rightly so, the JWS process couldn't or were not permitted to address hydro and community water supplies in the policy context.
No, because
so
it needed, it does actually, no, this is your chance.
Yes.
And we took that approach because we just needed to be making some calls.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's why you're seeing this language, not for the first time, because Ms. Stiles' evidence has been consistent around new permits. The new language is my more constrained
understood
settlement offer. For want of better words. So that's new, and then I come to the deem, the replacement consents. And I should say the blue, if I'm correct, is the language of Mr. De Pausmaker.
Yep. Right, so read the blue.
Yeah.
2, 3, accept.
And I just, well, the thinking with Ms. Stiles was that there still needed, in a policy sense, and you may disagree, some sort of policy recognition or hook for the rules that followed for the carve-out. And that's purely why that's there, Mum.
So the blue, sorry, blue
the
is...
blue was the pulse maker.
Oh, right, and red is you.
Yeah.
And the, this is new in the case of duration. Oh, I see. And that's so that there is a policy hook.
Yes, Mum.
For the carve-out.
Now, just to confuse matters, that read in 10A23 I drafted yesterday morning, and it doesn't completely line up with the restricted discretionary wording I've presented under F on the loose piece of paper.
Mm.
So I, while standing here on my feet, I just realised that's not quite matching up. And I prefer the loose piece of paper language.
Mm.
But anyway, the purpose of providing the changes in 2.3 is simply to be that policy hook, whatever that may be, Mum.
Mm-hmm.
Then I come down to the rules, and this may be where I've taken the court more literally than you were intending through your questioning, because I was suggesting a way forth could be the discretionary route for a longer-term consent for these replacement consents. I was very encouraged by the questioning. So there, that's what brought me to, you know, let's put up an alternative, which is the loose piece of paper. That's the new rule for the RDA.
Mm.
Either or, Mum, but my preference clearly is the RDA in light of the court's questioning yesterday.
So that gets us to your loose leaf.
Yes, so that's the loose leaf. So what I've done there is, I've taken the rule provides for the limited class of hydro replacement consents, which are set out in Mr. DePalsmaker's schedule, and that appears in the box at the bottom of that loose leaf. And all I've done is inserted the coordinates for the intake locations that were to be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had Trustpower provide those to me. I've set out Mr. Palsmaker's suggestion that the RDA rule here would reflect the matters of control, and then in response to those issues around duration need not always be neutral, or is not neutral all the time, versus the difficulty around the lack of architecture,
yep.
I've proposed with Ms. Stiles' input matter F. So I've tried to limit the class, and I've tried to give, you can't have it always, Mr. Welsh, so I've put in F for the ability for the decision maker to actually turn its mind as to how the applications can or don't provide for a longer term in terms of the adverse effects.
Now, I see that there's no drop-dead date.
No, and that's what I was going to talk to you as well, Mum. So I haven't put in a drop-dead date, but I'm very happy for it. Well, Trustpower would be most happy with a drop-dead date of May 2038. That then aligns completely with Waipori and Deep Stream.
Okay.
And there's no issue with having a drop-dead date.
Very good.
Okay, if I bring you back into my submissions, Mum.
Oh, no, just pause there. I'm just looking at matters of discretion. Okay, yep.
Right. Yeah, I'm at 4.7, and I should have just read this out because it does what probably more eloquently than I've just done. in terms of setting out those changes. So I'm just trying to scan if there's anything mm-hmm. else I need to... Well, in 410 I confirm the date of 2038, and I've said that's perfectly acceptable for a drop-dead date. And then in 414 I talk about bolstering that policy 649, but I accept we cannot amend that in terms of scope. But I just say that an integrated management approach would be to limit the maximum term to 2038. Then in 415, I just take you through why, in my view, these changes are appropriate, and I might just take you through that, Mum. In A, I say the existing Waipurian Deepstream HEPS have been the subject of evidence before the court. Limiting the relief sought in the manner proposed goes towards addressing Mr. De Palsmaker's concerns raised in evidence regarding a lack of evidence on other operators' schemes, and his comment that detailed technical information around the implications of Plan Change 7 on the operation of HEP schemes has been nearly exclusively provided by expert witnesses on behalf of Trustpower. So I'm trying to respond to that observation. And B, the Waipori Deepstream HEP is of regional and national significance in terms of its contribution to achieving renewable energy targets. Excluding Trustpower's Payrail and Paddy Rowa scheme as proposed avoids broadening the scope of the provisions to a scheme that has an association with irrigation. The Waipori scheme is likely to be subject to consent applications and decisions for maintenance and or enhancements within the life of Plan Change 7, and in fact, I say, has already got two permits that have been lodged. Trustpower acknowledges that it is unusual for planning documents to include provisions specific to certain schemes or assets, being the Waipori and Deep Stream, as proposed both by Mr. De Palsmaker and in Annexure B, but I submit that this is an appropriate response which provides certainty with respect to the scope of the provision being the scheme for which the court has heard evidence on. The objectives, PC7 objectives have been the subject of caucusing by the planner. No detailed proposed amendments to those objectives are included in B. However, I submit that if the court is so minded to include specific recognition for hydro within PC7, then it would be appropriate to include a simple hook for hydro renewable electricity generation within the objectives, and that comes back to that discussion, Your Honour, I've just had with you.
Funnily enough, that's I think what Mr. Anderson was doing as well. He was providing in his redraft of that objective. I didn't like all of it, but because there was a hook there for your activity.
Yeah. And that's all I've tried to do. The wording may not be attractive to the court, but it was the simple hook. In terms of Mr. Anderson's suggestions, Trustpower's firmly in the version A camp in terms of compromise. I think compromise it is just completely uncertain, and I'm not sure how anyone measures it, unless it's in the most egregious application that's so completely and utterly contrary. I'm not sure how an individual applicant, compromises the rolling out of an entire planning framework unless we all accept that each application creates a precedent effect. I struggle with that.
Mm-hmm. Or a plan integrity effect, perhaps.
Of
it that way.
Five, I just set out why it's appropriate to have a longer term regime. I'm not sure, Mum, I need to flog the horse on that.
You're saying what you said before.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
I would just take you down to 5.3. I just note in 5G that needs to be updated in respect of that proposed restricted discretionary one-pager. So it could read in G, the applications are proposed to be restricted discretionary activities with a matter of discretion relating to duration.
Sorry, where are you?
I'm in 5.2G, Commissioner.
5.2G.
And one of the problems with it being remote. I haven't had a chance to update these. So the full 5G would read, the applications are proposed to be restricted discretionary activities with a matter of discretion relating to duration, full stop, and strike the rest. Provision for a longer term, I'm in 5.3 now. Provision for a longer duration consents for hydro has been supported in principle by a range of experts and parties during the Plan Change 7 hearing. And I set out in A to D those, including Mr Brass, for the Director General of Conservation, who appeared to support in principle longer term consents for hydro. Ms McIntyre, who also acknowledged there may be circumstances where hydro may justify a longer term, and Mr Ensor for the Minister for the Environment, and Ms Dicey for ORAG. I comment on the RPS, Mum, just in the context of I'm not going to foreshadow any of the submissions I may make, but really it does, I just want to point out that it does, at least as notified, show that some of the submissions I've been making throughout this hearing are where the new planning framework regime may very well head, at least as notified. So I just wanted to point those out to you. So in 6.3, the upshot is that the proposed RPS is consistent with Trustpower's case during this hearing. Nothing Trustpower has identified in the proposed RPS detracts from the arguments made on Trustpower's behalf at the hearing, nor the relief it is seeking. If anything, I submit the proposed RPS provides additional support to Trustpower's case. But I fully acknowledge the weight to be given to the RPS is limited due to the very early stage we're at in that lifespan. I don't submit that you need to take this into account whatsoever, but I just thought it may be interesting in terms of the exposure draft. Well, everything relative in terms of interesting.
It's another document that I have not been tempted to read yet.
No. But I just thought that in terms of what the future may hold, and I say may, there is in Clause 6 a requirement that for an increase in generation storage, to promote the increase in generation storage, transmission and use of renewable energy, and also climate change. I expect you to do nothing with that, ma'am. I'm not submitting it otherwise. I just thought it shows that the future may not be so entirely inconsistent with the case I've been trying to present.
Okay.
124, Your Honour, you wish to have that in writing, so Council will address the court.
Well, you declined to give a spoiler alert, you see, so now you've got to actually commit.
Yeah, so the council has addressed, Council has addressed the court on the application of 124. I do not wish to canvass those matters again. However, for the avoidance of a doubt, Trustpower is Freudian slip, is not seeking the court to make a finding on 124 as it relates to deemed permits. If the court considers it does not need to, I can't tell you as counsel that you should not. I can only submit that I do not consider you need to.
Thank you.
So come to my principal submission. And that is that the relief sought by Trustpower appropriately gives effect to all applicable higher order planning documents. And in terms of Section 32, the relief sought by Trustpower is the most appropriate means of achieving the purpose of the Act.
Right.
And, Mum, I just want to thank, because this is my closing and I don't intend to be back here next week, just want to thank the court, the full bench, for your perseverance and the manner you've conducted the hearing. And I also really want to also acknowledge my colleagues. It's unfortunately the collegiality that I've experienced here is not always replicated in hearings, and I just thought I wanted to acknowledge
that. Island thing.
Yeah, well, for an Aucklander, it's refreshing. So
I think.
I just wanted to acknowledge that on the record.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You've run a really focused, tight case, and that has been of enormous assistance, so thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
They are my submissions.
Yep, I don't think we've got any questions.
No, we asked them on the way through.
All right, thank you. Deserving.
feet up, but yeah. That is only because of injury. There you go. Now I'm with you.
Excellent. Now, these submissions have perhaps taken a slightly unusual approach in mm-hmm. that the court will probably recall that we had a number of questions asked of us by you. And as I've worked yeah. through those questions, they've really touched on the key issues that I wanted mm-hmm. to discuss in closing. So the closing takes the form of responding to those questions and rather than taking a normal approach to closing submissions.
No, but Council came back with an agreed set of issues.
Yes.
So, all right, and so you're now working through those.
Yes,
okay.
I have. The other topic that is addressed in here is the question of scope for the relief that Mr. Twos has suggested in his most recent supplementary evidence. Do you want me to take you through those submissions, or would you prefer just to take those as read?
No, I need you to take me through those. Thank you.
So in terms of scope, obviously the Regional Council has taken the position that the new rule proposed by Mr. Twos was not on the plan change, because in the Council's opinion it was either unrelated to the Plan Change 7 case or prejudicial to potentially affected persons or both. Now, I accept that the test set out in Clearwater Resort Limited and Christchurch City is the appropriate test for assessing what is on the plan change. I submit that the assessment of that requires a more pragmatic approach to the mischief which Mr. Twos's new rule seeks to remedy. Despite what may have been intended by the Regional Council in notifying Plan Change 7, Policy 10A2.2 does change the way that new water takes for community water supplies can be consented. The Regional Plan Water recognises community water values which are provided for by community water supplies, and Plan Change 7's policy regime creates a highly directive overlay with respect to duration that fails to provide for the ongoing obligations of the territorial authorities. Council submits that this is a change to the status quo that is not just an indirect policy sidewind, but is a fundamental change to the management regime that adversely affects the TA's ability to satisfy their obligations. Turning to the test for on a plan change, in Palmerston North City Council and Motor Machinist, Justice Koch describes the bipartite test in the Clearwater this way.
Do you want us to read that for ourselves?
If you'd like to
use it. Yeah, and I'd like to get that back into my mind. Now, your submission here is addressing the concern as to new water.
Yes, yep. That's right.
Not replacement consent.
Correct, yep. Yes.
All right, functional inquiry. Oh, yes. Sorry, I read paragraph 8 too.
Yep. So the first limb of the test requires the court to compare what would have been without the plan change and what will be after it. This is an inquiry into what the plan change will actually do. The Court in Clearwater reasoned that if the effect of a plan change is to change the function of parameters in an unchanged part of the plan, then this would be open to challenge. It is submitted that Policy 10A 2.2 functions more like a rule than a policy. It supersedes all other policies in the plan.
So policy functions more like a rule, and then you said more than a policy, but you have...
Yes, well, 10A 2.2 is a policy, not an objective, so it's just an error on my part. And
how do you want that sentence to read?
So it is submitted that Policy 10A 2.2 functions more like a rule than a policy.
All right, thank you. I'll just make that correction.
It supersedes other policies in the plan and strongly directs new water takes only be granted for 6 years or less, thereby constraining the parameters of the relevant provisions of the regional plan water, even though the words of those provisions remain unchanged. In my submission, this is not an isolated policy directive as suggested by the Regional Council. Instead, it is a substantive change which affects the Territorial Authority's ability to satisfy their medium and long-term obligations under the Local Government Act and the Health Act. Had Policy 10A 2.2 not been included in Plan Change 7, then Council would understand the position taken by the ORC with respect to the scope of Plan Change 7. However, by virtue of this policy, it results in a functional change to the status quo for both replacement and new community water takes. Council for the ORC refers to the public notice for Plan Change 7, which provided that a plan change proposes an objective policy and rule, or objectives, policies and rules that manage the replacement of deemed permits with water permits and the replacement of expiring water permits and facilitates the transition from the regional plan water for Otago to a new fit-for-purpose regional land and water plan. This statement does not reflect the function of Policy 10A 2.2, which introduces an additional control for new water takes. Council submits that admitting the functional effect of the plan change on new water takes for community supplies, or any other new water take for that matter, in the public notice does not mean that these submissions are out of scope. It simply indicates that the ORC failed to articulate the full effect of Plan Change 7 in its public notice.
I'll just pause for a second.
It is further submitted that differentiating between direct and indirect changes caused by Plan Change 7 applies an unnecessary gloss to the inquiry into what the plan change does. Plan Change 7's policy 10A 2.2 changes the assessment of new takes. It is little moment whether this is a direct or indirect change within the plan change. Mr. Twoos's proposed rule 10A31A.2 seeks to rationalise and consolidate the provisions of Plan Change 7 as they relate to community water supplies. As discussed in his evidence, this recognises the special nature of these supplies and their recognition as a Tier 2 priority under the NPS for freshwater management. Turning to the status quo without Plan Change 7, without Policy 10A 2.2, the status quo requires the Regional Council to assess new community takes as a discretionary activity and to consider the various obligations and constraints, including those relating to duration. The crux of the TA's position is that policy 10A2.2 changes this assessment by restricting the potential duration of a consent to 6 years. Policy 10A2.2 is highly directive, such that it functions much like a rule, as I have pointed out. Whether advertent or not, this is a functional change to the assessment in relation to new takes, and as such, alternative methods to address this are on the plan change. The TA's proposed rule integrates specific considerations of actual water use, measurement, proposed water management, alongside duration, which is more appropriate for community water supplies. These reflect the types of considerations that are likely to flow from the Council's developing freshwater management regime pursuant to the National Policy Statement. It is submitted that the TA's proposed relief satisfies the first limb of the clear water test, since Policy 10A2.2 changes the assessment of new community water supply takes, and the relief proposed is directed at this functional change to the status quo.
Right. So, ORC's concern in relation to new takes, sorry, and I've neither got an ORC submission in front of me nor your original submission on the plan, and of course it was made by four or five TAs, but and they all might have taken different approaches, but ORC's concern is that not one TA made a submission on the duration policy for new takes?
No, I don't think it was that. I think that none of the relief specifically sought to bring a rule into Plan Change 7 that addressed the new takes of water.
So it wasn't so much that TAs hadn't made a submission on new activities.
Correct.
And is your submission because it had? They have.
Yeah. It's slightly opaque, I have to confess.
Oh, okay. So opaque
in the various submissions.
Yeah.
The submission that I draw your attention to in particular was the submission from the Queenstown Lakes District Council, which addressed the issues around the replacement and enlargement of water takes. And as we know, a consent that would essentially increase a water take would require a new application under the operative plan. So, in my view, and I think it's a view shared by Mr. Twos, is that that provides direct scope for the relief that he proposes. But equally, the other submissions which raise questions around the policy, I believe also provide scope because we're in essence proposing an alternative method to address the mischief that the policy has created.
And so do I take it that reading across the TA's individual submissions or further submissions, we will find submissions on policy 10A2.2?
Yes.
You will?
Yes.
Okay. And so is the only issue that the relief being pursued by Mr. Twos is not the same relief as you originally submitted?
Correct. And that relief essentially includes a rule that pulls in new takes, whereas obviously the notified version of Plan Change 7 didn't directly seek to regulate new takes
via
a rule. Yes.
Yeah, because it was amending a policy in the operative plan, or a new policy as to duration, but no rules.
Correct.
And so now what Mr. Twos has done is introduced a rule clearly pertains to those new activities, and that's the offending part.
That's my understanding of the Council's position, yes.
And you're saying
that is true, that's what Mr. Twiggs is doing, and that is what he's doing.
Yes.
But that's not a problem because there was a submission made on policy 10A 2.2.
Yes.
And at least as far as QLDC go, they were dealing, their relief was dealing with both replacement and enlargements, with enlargements being within the new water camp.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
There are, and I highlight them in the footnotes, some other submissions from other parties that seek, I think, again, in slightly opaque terms, but rules to implement policy 10A 2.2, and an example of those is the Forest and Birds submission, and I highlight the relevant paragraph of their submission.
Which footnote are you at?
Number 10 on page 5.
So if we were to read Fish and Game, we would also see relief seeking rules for new activities?
Well, it's essentially, it's a fairly broad submission, seeking that there should be rules that implement policy 10A 2.2 in effect. They don't propose any specific drafting or that type of thing, but does raise the spectre of a specific rule for.
And then they propose one. It's a non-complying activity should you go over 6 years. And that is also relief that we're considering.
Yes. Yeah. So I think when you look at what was raised in the submissions on behalf of QLDC, I think the issue is flagged there. I think that the relief essentially flows from those submissions around the policy and the effect of that policy, so that falls within the scope of Plan Change 7.
So I understand the submission, and I'll read the submissions filed last year with that in mind. Yeah, you weren't your clients didn't make a further submission in response to Fish and Game, though.
No, they did not.
No, okay. All righty. Thank you. I'm not quite sure. Where did you get to? 24.
Yes.
Procedural fairness.
So the Regional Council expressed some concern that the restricted discretionary status of the rule limits the ORC's ability to consider the environmental effects of new takes for community water supplies, and that this limitation may result in potentially affected persons not having an opportunity to be heard. It's my submission that the proposed relief doesn't present a real risk of prejudice. Firstly, the effects of the new rule and consequential changes have been traversed in the Section 32AA assessment completed by Mr. Twos. Alternative pathways similar to those promoted by him were traversed in the submissions made in relation to Plan Change 7. The ORC did not, in their submissions, identify a particular group that may be at risk, and I would note that there is a broad spectrum of interests represented in this Plan Change 7 process, and if there was a risk, I would suggest that would be extremely low if it exists at all. Now, this is supported by the fact that the proposed rule relates to a limited range of takes, and those identified as having a second priority under Te Mana o Te Wai. Other potential water takes are in the third priority, and community water supplies are elevated vis-à-vis these third priority uses by the MPS objective, which in Council's submission has some bearing on the potential for there to be parties that would be affected. As a result, I submit the proposed relief passes the second limb of the clear water test and can be said to be on the plan change. We've talked about the scope within the submissions that were filed, but in there I've got reference to the relevant parts of the Queenstown submission and any others I thought might be useful. So, turning now to the questions that had been raised. The first question was whether the territorial authority's obligation is to provide drinking water or water, including drinking water.
See, I was working off your... I thought when we said, oh, look, these look to be the issues, can you confer and come back?
Mm-hmm.
You came back on the 7th of May, and
yes.
Some of them were just tweaked slightly, that was all. Some of the issues?
Very minor tweaks, I think. Yeah, substantially.
So you're working from that, your own memorandum? Or my minute?
I actually can't quite recall where I pulled these questions from. I think I cut and pasted them. I suspect they've come from our memorandum, because that would have been a Word document.
I certainly recognise that question.
Firstly, the territorial authority's obligation under the Local Government Act is to provide water services.
Yeah.
The Local Government Act, section 130, requires a territorial authority to continue to provide water services and maintain its capacity to meet its obligations. Water services is defined in the Local Government Act as water supply and waste water services. And water supply is then defined as the provision of drinking water to communities by network reticulation to the point of supply of each dwelling house and commercial premises to which drinking water is supplied. It is submitted that that meaning is readily apparent and that the obligation of the council is to provide drinking water. Now, I have previously traversed the interpretation of drinking water in the earlier submission, so I haven't sought to do that again here. The next question is, when assessing an application for a new or replacement permit, are the environmental effects of the end use a relevant consideration under the provisions of the Regional Plan Water? As set out in the evidence on behalf of the territorial authorities, Council have sought and obtained consents for the take and use of water for a particular purpose. That purpose can vary from consent to consent, but of most relevance, the consents for the purpose of community water supply. It is submitted that the use of water in these instances is the supply of water to the community. Now, I just thought it would be useful to provide a bit of context around the inclusion of use within the provisions of the Regional Plan Water. So prior to Plan Change 1C becoming operative, the plan referred simply to the take of water. Plan Change 1C, which was promulgated to help address water allocation issues, added the term use. And it also, in its operative form, added a new rule to Chapter 12, which I've referenced at my footnote 13, which created a permitted activity rule for any use of water associated with a take consent granted prior to 10 April 2010. It's submitted that the activity that is relevant in the context of these take and use consents is the purpose for which the water is taken, that being a community water supply, what I characterise as the primary use. It does not extend to the downstream activities undertaken by people who have been supplied with the water from the scheme or the consequences of such activities that are controlled by other sections in the Act and what I'd call the subsequent uses. Therefore, the consequential effects of water quality arising from the subsequent uses or discharges of water provided via the community supply scheme are not relevant. This is inherent in the scheme of the Act. The take and use of water is managed under Section 14, whilst discharges and land uses are controlled by Sections 15 and 9, respectively. The provisions in the regional plan water function in a similar way. Depending on the nature of the subsequent use, discharges arising from it may be a permitted activity pursuant to rules in the regional plan water, and now Plan Change 8, or the specific user will need to obtain consent. Those subsequent uses are not authorised by the water permit. A good example, I think, of that scenario relates to the treatment of sewage and associated discharges. The discharge of treated wastewater is not authorised by the take and use consent, despite it being a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the community water supply. The consequences of the subsequent use of the community water supply requires its own consent to discharge, and that is the best that forum is the best place for assessing the effects arising from that. The High Court in Ngāti Awa held that the starting point for the consideration of end-use effects is that subject to Part 2, Section 104(1)(a) requires a consent authority to have regard to any actual and potential effects on the environment of allowing the activity.
Now, I don't really need to be addressed further on end use of water. I'm familiar with all of those cases.
That's fine.
Yep.
I'm happy to move past that. So if we carry on...
I think that you should. And just bear in mind this guidance. Has Mr. Twoth proposed something which your clients support?
Yes.
And if he has, then do the issues that you're raising need decision, or are they potentially working again or against his relief? And I think that's where we've had the difficulty, where planning is saying one thing, council, sometimes we can knock our confidence in terms of those outcomes that Mr. Twoth is seeking. So just bear that in mind, because Mr. Twoth has done a sterling job, which I think Mr. DePalsman says he's done a sterling job too. He has. He's really given those provisions in the operative plan a big nudge.
Mm-hmm.
Whether ORC goes with that in some future plan, I don't know. But I don't doubt that most TAs have as a primary use water for drinking water purposes. But some TAs don't, which is, you know, the problem that we have with Clutha. So if you're wanting to... And the problem with Clutha, as I understand it, is that the environment is changing about it. And there are water quality issues, and another environment's water quantity issues. Mr. Twoth was of the view that you can't have long-term duration consents. You need it. So he was of the view that, I think he said he had 15 or 20-year duration consents, because at that point then you need to do another check on the environment, that the taking is happening in the context of. That might resound in different approaches being taken under a water management plan. And I think Mr. De Palsmaker said, yeah, if there was a change in that future environment, so in the setting of where, you know, TA's taking is happening, you may need to go back and revisit the TA consent. And the likely place to revisit it was under a water management plan. Now, other witnesses like Ms. Muir was totally again revisiting anything in relation to TA consents, but Mr. Twoth's evidence was not that you could indefinitely roll over and roll over and roll over these consents. You had to be cognizant of the new environment setting after, you know, after a period of time, you know, 10 years, 15 years, not 6 years, 15 years, 20 years, 35 years, but you had to at some stage stop and have a look at the context that that taking was happening. And I have no difficulty in principle with that, and I have certainly no difficulty in principle with the need to actually, for this council and every other council in the land now to reconcile the three MPSs that we're dealing with. Where it gets, so there's a, I think your submissions have introduced uncertainty, where perhaps no uncertainty exists, at least from Mr. Tweezer's thinking and approach.
Yes.
Mm. And it's introduced it by saying all water must be treated to a drinking water standard, therefore all water is supplied for drinking water purposes, when we know darn well that is not the case in some districts. As in Clutha, drinking water for human consumption was a secondary purpose.
Well, I don't...
I know you don't agree with that. I know you don't agree with that, but because but that's created uncertainty for your clients, where I just, for the most part, I just don't think that should exist because, yeah.
Yes, and it is, I think, challenging because the there is a wide variation in the nature and form of the community water supplies that the various councils manage.
Mm.
And I think that in the context of a plan change, what I think that means is that there should be a pathway that allows us to look more closely at those individual circumstances and adapt accordingly. And that's, in essence, what Mr. Tweezer's option provided for in particularly broadening or introducing those aspects of water management and efficiency and so on, so that those received more careful attention as a result of Plan Change 7 than they have perhaps done under the Regional Plan Water. And that would, I think in my submission, be a... well, allow for some of the issues or concerns that have perhaps arisen in relation to the likes of the Stirling scheme. Because I think what we also need to recognise with these schemes is that, as the Regional Plan Water identifies, they have become important and are often relied upon by the communities that they serve. And so I don't think it's likely to be a palatable outcome if they are simply cut off entirely. But if some of the broader uses that they currently serve are cut off, there will need to be...
How do you mean broader uses that they
serve? Well, things like the dairy shed washdown, for example, that's provided by the Stirling scheme.
But I think that was Mr. Tweezer's evidence. He was actually trying to close that out.
Yes, and I think that you know, that's possibly where it will end up. The question is, how do we facilitate that? And that's something I think that could be and can be addressed consent by consent, utilising the matters of discretion that Mr. Tooze has included in his rule.
There is another approach, though. If you're wanting to, if the district council wants to become, it's almost like a water control authority supplying water for the primary sector, If that is one of its purposes, or a purpose that it has carved out for itself, if that is what it wishes to do, then it needs to happen in a way which resonates or responds to the prevailing environmental circumstances. And the fourth point for Stirling is where there is a change in the environment which is happening, particularly in terms of water quality, if you trace through the documents presented by Tom Heller and his evidence. Mm-hmm. He did not take the court through all of the trend analysis that was contained in some of his documentation. But if you have a look at that, then that tended to indicate that you needed to push pause, have regard to the environmental setting that activity was in, and then decide if that was one of your purposes, what responses there should be in a water management plan, as opposed to saying, well, that's not our problem, that's the region's problem. So in other words, integrated management is what really needs to be taking place.
Yes, and I suppose there's the point where I might depart with you on that, is whether those effects and changes that are arising in water quality are effects that fit within the forum of the take and use permit.
Yes, or relate to that subsequent that. And you would say they're outside of our permit.
Yes.
But what Mr. True said was that you actually had to have a fixed duration because the environment in which that permit is being exercised changes or will change over time. And then you needed to have regard to those environmental changes and how a consent on application for renewal might respond, and that seemed eminently sensible.
Yes.
So, for example, to take another example that does not apply, at least I don't think it applies to Stirling, you might be taking water, a volume of water, in a water short catchment, which is getting shorter by the day. I'm thinking here of OFA.
Mm-hmm. Omakau, I think.
Omakau, Omakau. And so at the time you were actually consented, there was water available for that scheme, but now, 20, 35 years on, the water source has become unreliable. And it's not become unreliable necessarily because of TAs, community water, because it's been taken in supply for community water purposes, but for other demands which are now on the same environment for the same water, it becomes unreliable. Do you just ignore that you're in a water short catchment and roll it on for another 35 years? Or is there time again, is there a need to push forward and say, well, let's look at the broader planning, what's going on in this catchment, and then make careful decisions around allocation needs?
Yes. I would say that my understanding of the reliability issue in relation to Omakau was to do with sedimentation and the fact the surface water is prone to sedimentation.
Okay, then so just take that example as a hypothetical as opposed to Omakau.
Yeah.
It's hypothetically, your environment's changed. Do you just say, I want another 35-year consent? That's none of the environmental issues, water shortage and over-allocation has nothing to do with us. It's everything to do with the dairy farmers or whoever you want to blame it on.
Mm.
Or do you stop and have a wider look at, in an integrated fashion, as to the allocative needs or demands of various groups, subject to Tier 1 or to Manurewa? And I would have thought it was the latter.
Yeah, and I don't think we're disputing any of that. And I think that Mr. Twoos's matters of control, and I think as Mr. De Pulsemaker pointed out yesterday, have primarily focused on the sort of demand side element of that and what the TAs can be doing to ensure that they're not just taking water for water's sake.
Yep, and there's no dispute about that. Yep. The court suggested those mechanisms, but at least to have regard to that, and he has done that, and he's done it. I thought I'm reading it very well, but I don't know the views of my colleagues on that.
Mm.
He's done an excellent job. But that's the problem. The problem that the court got, and I think your client has, as Bishop of Newater, is that that integrated planning hasn't been done.
Yes. accept
so
that.
So it's not an end use of water per se argument. And as I said, we've been really struggling with, we've got good relief we think we can work with Mr. Twos. Maybe, don't know, because there's some key decisions that need to be made. And then potentially legal submissions which undermine our confidence about where Twos relief would go should be put in a plan.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, the issue that has been of particular concern to the territorial authorities is the issue that arises from the likes of the Omakau Lugget schemes, where because they're replacing an existing water supply, but the way that the rules operate means it's a new consent. And it creates an awkward, or it is an awkward fit with the way that Plan Change 7 has sought to manage matters. And I think as described in the evidence on behalf of particularly Queenstown and Central Otago, the short-term nature of Plan Change 7 butts up against the way that the territorial authorities plan their infrastructure and seek to manage that.
I think that could be said for the primary sector, though. It butts up against people's succession planning, people's desire and laudable desire for moving from inefficient irrigation to efficient irrigation. It butts up.
Yes.
And that seems to me to be a reflection of the absence of integrated management at a regional, and then it follows a district scale.
I mean, if we're looking at it from a district scale perspective, and I think conceptualise it in terms of the sort of infrastructure planning exercise that territorial authorities are responsible for, then preparing their infrastructure, ensuring they have long-term access to the water to supply that infrastructure, is entirely consistent with their obligations.
But it takes place in the context of regions' own responsibilities, and hence it's a conversation which is happening between those local authorities. And it's not one prevailing against the other, but very much a drive, especially under the NPSUD, for integrated management.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And that's where those tensions get reconciled, and Hydro gets a look in occasionally as well.
Yes.
Because Hydro then comes in under its own REG.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the thing that we're trying to achieve here is essentially acknowledging that things are not as they should be from an integrated management point of view. And how do we, I suppose, shepherd the territorial authorities through recognising that challenge, but also recognising the strategic planning obligations that the territorial authorities have. And where we, in essence, have landed on that is through the relief that Mr. Twos has promoted. What I would say is that where Mr. Twos has landed is not the dream result from the territorial authorities' point of view. You know, that they would still like to see, water access and consents being secured for much longer terms than what Mr. Twos has suggested. But they, I think, accept, albeit begrudgingly, that we've got a process that we need to work through here to get the regional planning framework up to speed. And so something that is, there's an accommodation required on their behalf in order to facilitate that. And that's the 15, or end up to 2035 date that Mr. Twos has suggested. Quite what happens beyond that, I don't know. We might find by then we have an allocation regime in place that will mean that they can get longer term consents again, I don't know. We felt that was a reasonable place to land, recognising the different things that need to be achieved.
Okay, now I need to think about that. Need to think. Your luggage example yesterday was enlightening, only because I haven't gone back and reread all of the TA's evidence coming into this week of the hearing, but, you know, understand what they want to achieve at Luggett, but we're moving from one water body to another. It does demand a full environmental effects assessment. And it's like, well, Mr. Twos is not offering that. And
And then
see, that's difficult. Yeah.
It is difficult, and I acknowledge that challenge. And I think in the questions I asked of Mr. De Pelsenmaker yesterday, tried to explore what possibilities there might be to address that.
Where were you going on the issue of an effects assessment for new water?
Yeah, so I thought there were potentially two options there. The first one would be to effectively have Mr. Toos's rule apply in addition to the operative provisions relating to the new water takes.
So to have Mr. Toos's rule apply in addition to?
Yeah.
So sorry, what? Like the RD rule?
Yes, yeah.
As so, RD.
We can't change, I suppose, the activity status of the existing rules in the operative plan. So there's a rule where you're an identified scheme and you're replacing your consent, which is a controlled activity. If you're a new consent, it's a discretionary activity.
Yeah.
So that would, through the discretionary activity pathway, of course, make the assessment
but with no
all of the effects.
End game in sight because there's no policy.
Well, but that's where the policies in Plan Change 7 and the restricted matters of discretion in Mr. Toos's rule would apply.
No, that's just start that again.
Yeah,
so,
sorry,
start it again.
You've
lost me. But I am really interested. So don't think that we're not interested. We're interested. So the proposition is new activity.
So if we've got a new activity, under the operative plan, a consent for that activity would require a discretionary consent.
Equals a D. Okay. Yep.
So that means everything is on the table. That rule applies in conjunction with the rule under Plan Change 7.
So that rule, that discretionary operative regional water plan rule plus...
Yes. The restricted discretion...
Plus your RDA.
Yes.
And equals what, new water.
Correct. Mm. And so that, I think, it's not perfect, except that, but the extra matters that Mr. Twos had introduced around efficiency water management planning get pulled into the new consent regime, which is that nod to what is required under the NPS and on all of those things.
Mm.
But gives that opportunity for that broad assessment of the effects of that water take on a new water body, if that were to be the case.
And you've got a drop-dead date of 2035? Because,
correct.
You know, honestly, that duration policy is just... We've got the region there, but OK, so not the duration, so drop-dead date.
Yeah.
OK.
The other alternative, I think, would be to make Mr. Twos's rule a fully discretionary rule, perhaps for
But then that's problematic because you've been very hard. What are we doing with the effects?
And I think, the other thing to bear in mind, I suppose, on that is that the direction in the part of the plan, how do you use this plan, for the new takes, of course, requires the provisions in Chapter 5, 6 to apply. So in relation to the takes, I know you don't like them, but in terms of the effects of the take on the water body, there are at least some policy, objective and policy provisions that address those issues.
So that's kind of a fully discretionary rule. So that should part alternative to new activities, fully discretionary as to his proposals.
Matthew's proposal is restricted discretionary currently.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. So
you could leave it at that.
Yeah.
To cover the replacement consents.
Yep.
But for new consents, if it's additive, then the activity status would be discretionary by virtue of the rule and the operative plan and the bundling that would occur. So we introduce those efficiency water management obligations.
Yeah, that's what the efficiency water management obligations, where are they sitting now for Mr. Tuiz? Are they under a policy or under a rule?
They're in the rule from memory.
I mean, I was a little confused because it's in his restrictive discretionary rule, isn't it? I've got his document here. You said it was he was now sitting at discretionary, but isn't he now sitting at
This is a whole new way of looking at it.
Yeah, this is different.
Oh, sure, but I've got Mr. Tuiz's version here, and I'm just trying to turn to the relevant pieces that you're referring to so I can fully understand what you're suggesting. So. Oh, I find those under 10A.3.1.A2. Is that right?
Yeah. What's the date of his brief? I just want to.
It's the 12th of May.
I'll just go to a different source.
I better check I've got the right date for brief there. Yeah, 12th of May?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just getting into it. Rachel, can you just check, I've now got Mr. Tuiz's 12A brief, but can you just check it's actually on the website?
I couldn't find it on the website, and I found that I must have brought it with me, which was fortunate.
Okay,
I gave up yesterday looking for
it. So what you're suggesting is, so you've got option one, which is that it's option one for new activities that the... Let me see. It's still discretionary under the operative water plan, plus together with an RDA under this plan for new water. So it brings in the Tuiz's thinking. So that's your first option. Your second option is that it is simply fully discretionary under this plan, but that you need to, I think you're saying, you need to introduce Tuiz's thinking perhaps in a policy to this plan. So you're thinking with a discretionary hanging underneath it, but it would still need consent under the operative plan. And so, oh no, you're not thinking that. You're thinking bring in chapters 5 and 6 selectively from the operative plan.
I'm just trying to find the page. There's a preamble to the plan, which tells us how it works, which says, and it's on... like the third or fourth page of the provisions where it says insert the following text and how to use the plan. And it says for applications for water permits that are not replacing either a deemed permit or an existing water permit will be assessed in accordance with provisions in Chapter 5, 6, 12, blah, blah, blah. So if we had a discretionary rule in Plan Change 7 that essentially overtook the Chapter 12 rule. The provisions, the objectives and policies in Chapter 5 and 6 are intended to still be relevant because it is a new water tech. I'm inclined to think that the option one, the additive rules, is perhaps slightly neater. Another option three, perhaps, would be to introduce those extra elements that Mr. Twos identifies into the policy that would apply irrespective of whether the application was under the operative plan or only in relation to replacement consents under Plan Change 7. That would also overcome the Regional Council's concern about scope, because we're not adding a rule in relation to new water takes.
Say that one again.
If we incorporated Mr. Tooze's efficiency and water management requirements into the policy, that policy would apply to both an application under Chapter 12 for a new consent and an application under Plan Change 7 for a replacement consent. Because we wouldn't be adding a rule for new consents in that scenario, it wouldn't raise the issues that the ORC have expressed concern about in relation to scope, because we're not adding a rule that regulates new takes under Plan Change 7.
But that doesn't, that might address you a scope issue, but it doesn't address the fundamental issue of where you've got new activities. The policy thus far in the plan says 6 years. You want longer than 6 years. For that, ordinarily I would expect a full merits assessment, which is under the, which is under the operative plan at the moment for new consent subject to 6 years.
Yes, so I think if you were to deal with this via a policy route, there would be a policy specific to the community water supplies with the backstop date of 2035 that introduced those water efficiency, water management obligations, but because the new consent would require a discretionary consent under the operative plan, your full merits-based assessment can take place as a discretionary rule, and leaning on the provisions to the extent they exist to assess the effects of the take on those wider environmental matters.
So are you hanging this off a duration policy effectively? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
So the duration being up to 2035, and then you're hanging those extra things off it? Is that what you're suggesting?
So if we look at Mr. Twos's suggested changes in his supplementary brief, his suggestion in relation to 10A2.2 is the 6-year duration, except where the rule applies, which suffers from that drafting.
Oh, reaching in and plan to write your policy and using rules.
Except where rules. We ignore that for a moment. The resource consent granted will expire before 31 December 2035. So effectively, we'd elaborate that policy to cover those water management efficiency requirements. And then the rule that Mr. Twos suggests could apply only to replacement consents. In relation to new permits or new consents, the operative plan rules would apply, but of course policy 10A 2.2, and its extra machinery,
the duration
would kick in.
Expanded duration. Correct. Policy for community water supply.
Yeah.
There's a lot of content in those.
Yes.
Restricted discretionary matters, just in terms of thinking about them in policy terms, is that...
Yeah, I have to...
Are they...
I'm sort of making the...
Crafted in a...
Yeah, I'd need to... This isn't, I have to confess, not an option that I have explored with Mr. Too. So I'd probably need to work with him on that if we were to go down this route.
I think we'd probably, if we were mindful of going down the route, probably indicate that in an interim decision.
Mm.
So, you know, the options seem to be, from the regional council's preference, is 6 years either way, new or replacement.
Yes.
6 years for new or replacement, potentially longer, subject to the TWO's matters, in his new RDA, the replacement matters wouldn't just be what the couple of matters that he's noted, it would be actually be the full matters, full range of, full suite.
Mm.
Otherwise, what is the point of actually applying for a replacement consent? It's not a business as usual, the environment might have changed, including your population. Or your further suggestions, which is that I think that the policies are remaining the same, and for a new activity requires a discretionary consent under the operative plan. Everything's on the table in terms of a merit assessment,
mm-hmm.
plus a RDA rule under the new water plan, which is TWO's new mm-hmm. thinking, and a drop dead date of 2035. Or your second alternative seems to be amend 10A policy 10A 2.2, which is the duration for new consents, to bring in his thinking about his thinking around. Matters for consideration on an application for new water together with a drop dead date of 2025. And then his rule, such as he's got it, would only be a. So that's your policy consideration for duration. So otherwise, it's been processed under the operative plan. And mm-hmm. his rule, such as he's proposed it, would only apply to the replacement consents. But my thinking was, if you're looking for a replacement consent, you'd be looking to do all of the good stuff that he notes in his matters of. Discretion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So effectively, all of the good stuff is the quid pro quo for the longer term.
Yeah.
That you need to be beginning to take the steps toward those things, which is the sort of nod to the NPS requirements and moving in that direction. And to do that, or to get the longer term, you've got to commit to that.
So it's more than just about the longer term. The other element is you get what the DEEM permit or the up to 25 permit allowed.
Mm.
So there's no historical use
review
of it. You can have whatever volume, rate of take and volume your DEEM permit
was a subtle
allows,
change.
If in some cases it even specifies that with any particularity. I don't actually know the answer to that. Do we know the answer to that?
most of the permits specify a rate of take and... feel like it's generally an annual volume. dynamic. Some of them might have a maximum daily volume, but they don't tend to have the monthly volume that is you tend to see on the irrigation consents. And my understanding in relation to that is because of the potential for there to be some wild variations.
Big needs, yes. Yeah. We heard evidence on that.
Yes. So they do provide a little more elasticity than the other permits.
I guess I'll just raise it just so that we don't forget that.
Yes.
Other element.
Yeah. I just thought that where we had actually landed on that was the way that the schedule operates is to is just not to kind of trim back the atypical data, but you still do that same analysis. And then
sorry, the schedule? The
10A4 or whatever it's called. So that schedule still applies to replacement.
Well, parts
permits.
Of it do,
yes,
but not.
Yeah.
Though I think that was the point of some of the questions.
Correct.
That Commissioner Bunting asked yesterday. Some clarity required,
yes,
in terms of was it only that step,
yes,
4 that,
yes,
didn't apply?
That's my understanding. And I'd agree with the explanation that Mr. De Palsemaker gave to Commissioner Bunting's questions, that the reason that the atypical data analysis was agreed not to be appropriate for the community water supplies is because of their tendency to be
quite variable.
And when people need that water, they need that water. So, trying to remove that atypical data would potentially create an issue for the territorial authorities and require significant storage increases to address that.
Right, okay. Well, you can think about those options. And Mr. Moore can respond. You've got a fair idea as to what...
I was sitting here contemplating precisely what is it that I'm now responding to.
Yeah, that's a fair question. So that's why I'm asking you. Do you know precisely what you're responding to?
I understand there are now a range of options. I have no clarity over which option is being pursued and what it actually looks like.
What it looks like, I think that's
conceptually, I'm struggling, to be fair.
So, do you want to commit to writing? I can do.
Mm. I can do. Our thinking has evolved as we listen to the evidence and I acknowledge some of the concerns that Mr. De Palsemaker has raised in his reply, and so I suppose a bit like Mr. Welsh, I'm searching for ways to help address those things.
Mm.
So I can look at working something up.
Well, I think that's going to be really important because...
we're struggling with it too.
Well, I think I know where you're going, and then where I trip, I'm finding it difficult is then to understand, because Mr. Toews had sort of a fully worked up sort of approach for new consents, but something not marginally different for replacement consents, and why would you want it, just a couple of added matters? I think they're just a couple of matters. Three added matters for replacement consents under his rule. I just want to make sure that we are talking about bringing forward for both replacements and new consents all of his thinking.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I struggle in principle why replacement consents, if that's what they are, replacement consents, should not, if Mr. Toews' advice is to have another look at the environment in which they're set, because those environmental settings may have changed, why we're not having a broader look at both how the territorial authorities are going around their business of supplying and also the context in which they're supplying, a really careful look at that.
Yeah, no, I understand that problem.
Mm.
So we need to be on. We need to understand exactly, if you like, what's the offer.
Yeah, sure.
And need to know that probably before the end of business today. Although, you know, we'll rise at 2 o'clock. Everybody needs to know what is the offer here.
People have got a chance to have a look at us before we come back next week.
Mm. Yeah, because for replacement consents with a fully worked up environmental assessment is required. You kind of go, why would you want to depart from being in lockstep with the other MPSs?
Mm.
It's exactly what we, you know, you should be now, all authorities working together to collaboratively to resolve those, that higher order thinking under the MPSs, as opposed to one departing and saying, well, look, I'll, you know, blow that, Joe, they're a bit late. It's not fair. Every council in the country is under the same constraints and pressures. So we either push pause for 6 years or perhaps flesh out your two alternatives.
Mm. Mm. Okay.
Mm.
Do you want me to finish with the closing submissions or? I don't need to carry on with the end use.
Think you do. I mean, we're, you know, speaking for myself, stumbling around trying to understand why the end environment not be relevant. Why do we ignore what the environmental setting is for these TAFEs? I've thought it was an end use. You know, it is ultimately an end use problem because that sets the environmental setting that your activity is taking place in. But that is not to say you can control those end users.
Mm.
Mm. But it's not to say that the environmental context is irrelevant. And Mr. Tui says it's relevant. That's why he's come down on 15 years.
Yes, and I think, I mean, in terms of understanding the environment within which your take is coming from, I would agree that it is absolutely... that's where you start your analysis. I think where we perhaps depart is how far down the chain do you go in factoring in or accounting for the effects that are a consequence of your take that arise from the uses that may rely on your water.
Yeah, are enabled by your supply, yeah. and that's the key.
Yes.
That for this region is the key question, where there doesn't seem to be adequate controls on the broader, through its regional plans, plural, and that it now needs to stop and adapt and take an integrated management approach as opposed to a disaggregated approach, which is taken hitherto today. So, And the TAs have got caught up in that, but probably rightly so, because, you know, they need to be part of that integrated approach, not apart from it. Mm.
Yeah. So I think I think you understand the issues.
I think I better understand the issues as a consequence of this hearing, but I think I've always had concern as to the environmental context for some of this, some of the supply. Mm.
Okay. So if we carry on with, with some topics in relation to the relevance
NPSUD
of the National Policy Statement for Urban Development.
And you have followed Justice Palmer's ado approach.
Yes, I believe I have.
Oh, okay. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's comforting. So the application of the National Policy Statement for Urban Development is obviously set out in Clause 1.3.
Mm-hmm.
It applies to all local authorities that have all or part of an urban environment within their district or region, and to any planning decision that affects an urban environment. Depending on whether a particular territorial authority qualifies as Tier 1, 2 or 3, there are different obligations within the more detailed implementation provisions of the National Policy Statement. Dunedin and Queenstown, and then also Otago, are identified as Tier 2 authorities within Appendix 1 of the NPS. For the other councils, it's necessary to determine whether they contain an urban environment. It's apparent from the evidence that the councils themselves are at various places in the process in undertaking the work required to identify their urban environments in light of the relatively recent National Policy Statement and the changes to the definition of urban environment as compared with the previous Urban Development Capacity Policy Statement. Now, that particular question around the definitions was discussed in the submissions that I filed dated 23 April, so I haven't traversed that again. So in my submission, the NPS UD is relevant to Plan Change 7. It qualifies as a planning decision, and there are urban environments that will be affected by it. And that's on the strength of the evidence from particularly Ms. McGurr and Ms. Muir. Further inquiry will also be required into the relevance of the NPS urban development when specific applications for water permits are made to determine whether they themselves affect an urban environment in an individual case. And that is because resource consents are also identified as planning decisions within the National Policy Statement. So in that sense, if we take the Luggett v Stirling example, Luggett forms part of the Upper Clutha urban environment as identified by the Queenstown Council. So the NPS UD in my submission would most certainly apply to the assessment of that application. The question of whether it might apply to the likes of the Stirling take, I think, is a little bit less clear. I would say that the command area of Stirling itself wouldn't be an urban environment. The question for Clutha District, of course, will be what the extent of the urban environment is within the district, and that would need to be determined before you could be clear, I think, about whether or not the NPS was directly relevant to the assessment of a consent for the likes of the Stirling take. So it's submitted that giving effect to the NPS UD in this planning decision is best served by providing a pathway for the community water supplies to allow the territorial authorities to exercise their functions and meet their obligations under the NPS. Whether longer-term consents are required in each specific instance will be a matter for the decision-maker at the time of the consent application, when further more specific detail is available regarding the proposal for which the consent is sought. So the question of are the provisions of the NPS UD applicable to all TA permits to take and use water or only those within or supplying an urban environment? I think the NPS drafting is clear. It does only apply to permit applications within or serving or within an urban environment. And as I've said, would need to be determined at the time the specific application was made. But in relation to the Plan Change 7 decision, the relevance of the NPS UD is determined by whether there are or likely to be water permits supplying urban environments that are affected by the plan change. And in my submission, the evidence has been quite clear on that front, that there will be urban environments affected. Turning to the consistency or otherwise of the provisions in the NPS UD and the NPS for freshwater management, I think it's almost trite to say that national policy statements occupy the first tier of generality identified in the EDS case, and that those documents set the national direction through policy statements, which are then intended to flow through into the subordinate documents. And in my submission, this means it is the lower order documents that are required to reconcile any possible inconsistency between those national level documents. The National Policy Statement for Urban Development obviously requires local authorities to provide sufficient development capacity to meet expected demand over the short, medium and long term. Development capacity includes development infrastructure, and of most relevance here is network infrastructure for water supply. The NPSUD is in effect silent on water matters beyond that context of network infrastructure. At its core, the NPSUD drives that strategic and integrated planning and across statutes in some respects to meet its objectives. This includes ensuring development capacity can be served with infrastructure. The NPS for Freshwater Management, which was gazetted 3 months after the NPSUD, seeks to protect the well-being of waterways as its first priority and the health needs of people as the second. Clause 1.3 sets out the fundamental concept of te mana o te wai, and includes preserving the balance between water, the wider environment and the community. It is submitted that this is a recognition that water plays a role in all facets of sustainable management, and that will by necessity include the allocation of some of it. Looking at the relationship of these two documents to one another, the NPSFM clause 1.3, subclause 2, identifies that te mana o te wai is relevant to all water management. Therefore, to the extent that the NPSUD or actions required by it touch on water management issues, te mana o te wai will have a role to play. Whilst the NPS Urban Development is directed toward development and the NPSFM is directed towards protection, it is submitted that this difference of direction does not make them contrary to one another. And in my submission, this is evident from some of the provisions within the NPSFM itself, such as those at clause 3.22 and 3.24. The NPS carves out some exemptions for activities, or at least processes through which activities that may affect water bodies can occur, and that includes the likes of specified infrastructure. It's submitted that these provisions demonstrate how other facets of sustainable management can and should be accommodated within the context of te mana o te wai. It is submitted that the potential for inconsistency between the NPSs arises if you assume that the outcomes available under them are binary in nature. Specifically, that development capacity can only be provided by taking away from the health and well-being of water bodies. And whilst that's a theoretical possibility and may arise if an environmental bottom line was to be breached, for example, it isn't the only possibility, or indeed the most likely one, in my submission. Both documents need to be interpreted within the light of the RMA's purpose. Whilst the NPSFM sets clear requirements about providing for the health and well-being of water bodies, it is submitted that this is still required within the context of sustainable management. Effectively, in my submission, the NPSFM still contemplates an allocative regime. Crudely, it's a question of how much water is required to provide for the health of the well-being of a water body, and then how much may be available to serve the other community-centric well-beings to preserve the balance between them. In short, the holistic and symbiotic relationship between water, the environment and the community is enshrined within the concept of Te Mana o Te Wai and is not served if no water can be used at all. If that were the outcome of the NPSFM, then the purpose of the Act could be defeated. Finally, it is submitted that the obligation with respect to the NPSFM and NPSUD under Plan Change 7 is the same. They must both be given effect to, whether they are consistent or not. I observe that there is no statutory requirement for NPSs to implement one another. Implementation of them is a task left to the subordinate policy and plan makers, for better or for worse. It is submitted that achieving the reconciliation, if it is required, is a constraint on Plan Change 7, but not an issue of construction between the NPSFM and UD. I think it is accepted that Plan Change 7, as notified, does not and is not intended to give full effect to the NPSFM. And it remains, I think, an open question about whether that is an acceptable proposition under the Act. The provisions of Plan Change 7, as set out by Mr. De Pulsemaker, are, in my submission, inconsistent with the NPSUD because it fails to provide for any term beyond 6 years. As set out in the evidence on behalf of the territorial authorities, terms longer than that are necessary to support their provision of infrastructure, including to provide development capacity that is infrastructure ready and or compliant with the obligations they have under the Local Government Act and the Health Act. And the amendments proposed by Mr. Twoos had sought to address these shortcomings within the framework of Plan Change 7. So are the territorial authorities' statutory duties to take and supply water and the ORC's functions under the Resource Management Act Section 30 reconcilable under the NPSUD and FM? Now obviously the Act distinguishes between the functions that are held by regional councils and territorial authorities. There has been some extraneous commentary in environmental and resource management law texts identifying the additional regulatory pressures that territorial authorities will have in relation to drinking water and the establishment of Taumata Arawai. In particular, they note that territorial authorities will often also have a role of municipal water supplier. In respect of such water supplies, the water supplier is required to maintain certain levels of water quality and to protect sources of municipal water supply, and with particular reference to the NES in relation to sources of drinking water. Council interprets the court's question to mean that will the various implementation steps required under the NPSUD and FM provide a forum for reconciling the potentially competing statutory functions of the ORC and the territorial authorities? And to that, I would say I hope so, if done well. However, whether that may occur does not address the more immediate issue, being what to do with Plan Change 7. It is submitted that the court need resist the temptation, as strong as it may be, to leave this issue to be resolved later, which is what Mr. De Pulsemaker would have you do, and in my submission is not available under Section 67.3.
What do you think he's having us do, sorry?
Well, by in essence saying let's just hold the line for 6 years and then we'll address all these issues in the context of the land and water plan.
And remind me, what is subsection 3 of Section 67?
That you must give effect to a national policy statement.
But you would agree with me, would you not, that this planning instrument by itself cannot fully give effect to the NPSUD?
Yes.
Or REG?
Yes.
Or FM?
Yes.
So that it's constrained by its own scope. With the scope in mind, it then needs to reconcile those three NPSs.
Yes, no, I agree with that.
So there's no... So where's the submission driving?
It's driving at the fact, and I come to it in the following paragraphs, is that through Plan Change 7, you effectively need to do what you can to implement the various national policy statements.
Is that correct? Do what you can? Because that was the submission of WISE. Do what you can, you should, because you have the data available now, I think that's their submission, therefore you should have minimum flows or a flow regime imposed now. But that's well beyond, you know, the ORC would say, well, that's well beyond the scope of this plan change. So it's not doing what we can, because in theory you could do that, but then you would also miss out on other things that you can't do, and that might drive away from integrated management. So what does, it's not do what you can, it's do, it is giving effect to, I would have thought, the NPSs within the scope of the plan change.
And I mean, I think that's right. I don't think anyone is suggesting that through this plan change you can set minimum flows and allocation limits and things like that, which is the sort of full extent of particularly the NPS for freshwater management. But
and why can't you? Why can't you do that?
Well, I think, I mean, that is, I think...
In theory, you can, presumably, if you might have got the data, evidence available. In theory, you can, but why could you not? Because there is a reason in law, I think, why you could not. You could not because it's not on the plan change.
Yeah. I don't think I would go so far as to say that is a blanket statement, because it is possible, I think, that, and I think the theme was perhaps developed during earlier parts of the hearing about whether some of the challenges created by the lapse or expiry of priorities, say, could be addressed by an alternative regime. So I think there could be situations where setting some sort of minimum flow mark fall within the scope of this plan change. But I'm not suggesting that I'm advocating for that position on behalf of the territorial authority.
No. So you're saying that in, with regard to rights of priority, as the example, a solution could have been set a minimum flow. So if rights of priority expire in October, then a solution for this plan is create a minimum flow.
Possibly. If you could, or if it was possible to demonstrate that doing that would achieve the purpose of the plan change around trying to hold the line and do all of those sorts of things. And I think that approach sort of aligns with the submissions I made earlier around Mr. Toos's relief being an alternative method to achieve the same outcome. So I think there is more breadth, I suppose, in terms of the options you might have available to you than directly whether or not this plan change is notified ever sought to set minimum flows or whatever other method might have come up. But I don't think that's an issue that touches directly on the case for the territorial authorities.
No, I'm just wondering where your section 67.3...
Yeah.
Section 67, subsection 3 submission is actually going.
And if I take you to my paragraph 89, One of the policies within the National Policy Statement for Urban Development requires local authorities to provide at least sufficient development capacity at all times. And in my submission, that doesn't give the councils a free pass until they have completed the implementation steps required by the NPS. And further, Policy 8 within the NPSUD requires councils to be responsive to proposals that would add significantly to development capacity, even if it is unanticipated by planning documents or out of sequence. Such a proposal might arise at any stage. In my submission...
You see, I get to, let's not bother with integrated submission if you're correct, integrated planning. If you are correct, you do not need, the region doesn't need to bother to go down its RPS process. You just hear it, you can go out of step. You are no longer in step with a submission like that.
So...
That's not what's intended, I would have
thought. Well, I think what we've got to acknowledge is that getting to that place of integrated management doesn't happen overnight. So we have a period of time now where that end point, we're not there yet, we don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle in place. However, the obligations to provide for development capacity and so on still exist under the NPS, and in my view that's the thing that you need to be bearing in mind when you're thinking, well, how do I give effect to that? And in my submission, the way that you give effect to that within the context of Plan Change 7 is by providing a pathway. Now, that pathway...
And it is not the Regional Council's case, is it provides for new for all water, a territorial water, a pathway. It's a six-year consent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's provided...
Yes, that's their case. My case, or the territorial authority's case, is that that pathway is not long enough.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, we'll move on. So, your paragraph 90?
Yes. So, as I said, to give effect to the provisions, you have to provide a pathway. The position advanced on behalf of the TAs seeks to strike a balance between the need for the TAs to have some extra certainty for infrastructure planning and delivery purposes, and the ORC's need for water permits to come up for renewal within the life of the land and water plan. Turning to what is required for development capacity to be infrastructure ready, as I've previously identified, development capacity must be provided at three different time horizons: short term, being 1 to 3 years, medium term, 3 to 10, and long term, 10 to 30. It is submitted that what is required to be infrastructure ready will vary across these time horizons. The time horizons are, of course, rolling, and so infrastructure ready over the medium term needs to progress so that it becomes infrastructure ready in the short term in order to meet policy 2 of the NPS for urban development. Most relevantly for the purposes of these proceedings is what is required for development capacity to be infrastructure ready within the short and medium term, particularly given the life of Plan Change 7. Is submitted that short-term development capacity is intended to be capacity that is available to be called on with a degree of immediacy, i.e. it needs to be ready to go. For water supply infrastructure to achieve this, water actually needs to be available to deliver via the infrastructure. A pipe without water to go into it is not development infrastructure as contemplated by the NPSUD in my submission, for the simple reason it cannot do its job if there is no water. To perhaps demonstrate that point further, no council would accept a subdivision being ready to go if the roads were not formed and capable of being driven on. Suggesting that water supply infrastructure is ready without water is akin to saying legally vested but unformed roads are ready to be driven on. Over the medium term, it is my view that it is important to ensure that the water is available to serve the infrastructure that will be built in order to meet the infrastructure ready requirements in the short term. It is submitted that such an approach is consistent with the Council's strategic planning obligations under the LGA and the MPSUD, and the integrated management obligations that both councils have under the Resource Management Act. Now, it's tempting to say that it's not necessary to actually have water available until there are people to drink it. However, I submit that this approach would not represent sustainable management, as it runs the risk of infrastructure or development occurring that cannot be served with water supply via the infrastructure at the time it is required. It is submitted that Mr. De Pelsmaker's suggestion that territorial authorities must put all future development on hold until the Land and Water Regional Plan has been promulgated is totally at odds with the TA's obligations to provide development capacity on the short and medium term horizons. The TAs cannot do that. Putting infrastructure development on hold is exactly what the MPSUD was intended to stop territorial authorities from doing. The NPS provides the national direction for them to get on with it. Does the requirement for development capacity to be infrastructure ready require a water permit? I've already traversed that to an extent. I think that the answer to that is absolutely yes for short-term capacity and the early years of the medium-term capacity requirement, recognising that this needs to be maintained on a rolling basis. The only caveat that I would have to that is where a regional plan, through its water allocation provisions, has identified allocations specifically for water supply purposes, and there can be a high degree of certainty that water will be available when it is applied for. Finally, does the RPS or the Regional Plan Water allocate water for territorial authorities? On this issue, I agree with the discussion in Mr. Twoos's supplementary evidence of 12 May. The regional planning documents currently do not directly allocate water to community water supplies, and that's save for Welcome Creek, which is near the Waitaki River. There is some recognition for the need of the need for certainty for water supply values by virtue of the controlled activity rule for community water supplies identified within the schedules. Arguably, this is a form of allocation for community water supplies relative to other uses that require at least a restricted discretionary consent. But this allocation only applies to those existing supplies identified in the schedules.
Okay, thank you for your submissions. When do you think, if you want to pursue those two alternative points of relief, I do think we need something sketched out to make it quite clear exactly what you're proposing. And, you know, if you're bringing parts of that RDA, Mr. Trueser's RDA rule up into policy, what parts are you bringing up into policy and for whom? And then, I think. Yeah, because he treats new water and replacement water under the RDA rule differently, and I have not heard the justification or defence for that.
Yeah. I'll need to confirm, I'll need to take this to particularly the CRDC and Queenstown, and I do know that at least one of the people is on leave until Monday. If it could be, say, lunchtime on Monday, I could make that work, I'm sure, and confirm my instructions on that. I can do what I think it could look like by the end of the day, but I just won't have been able to run that past the necessary people.
What do you need, Mr. Moore, apart from certainty?
It would be helpful to have. I'd be happy to receive on a without prejudice basis the sketched out provisions.
A sketched out look, yeah.
Yes, because it will inform our thinking over the weekend in terms of framing up the response to the case put forward, and I appreciate that then may well change subject to instructions, but we'll have a better chance at amending submissions already written and writing submissions afresh on Monday night.
Yeah, no, that sounds sensible. So by the end of today, which means...
Yeah, midnight's fine.
No, it's not.
Oh, fine for me, I should say.
So.
Gonna have the evening off.
5 o'clock, how about that?
That's actually pretty sad if everybody's working till midnight, but no, 5 o'clock today, sketched out, handed over on a without prejudice basis. Obviously, the court's not going to see it until there's something to see. And then by lunchtime, Monday. All right. I think that's all for today. Any questions?
It's 2 o'clock. Excellent.
No, we're going. Ms. Williams.
I just have one question, Your Honour, and that's really on behalf of Ms. Dixon as much as anyone. That is Dr. Somerville. When is he coming back?
I still haven't spoken to him. Soon.
The reason I'm asking on behalf of Ms. Dixon is she's just trying to work out whether she should come for Monday afternoon or whether she needs to be here in the morning.
But not Monday. Not Monday. Monday's full.
Okay.
I think.
Right, so definitely not Monday.
No, not Monday. It'll be Tuesday, but I just must get round to talking to him. All right. Okay, so I think we're adjourned through to 9:30. And thank you for your submissions too. Spent a good deal of time with those, so I'm grateful. Right, and so we're adjourned. All rise.